Coming up, it's Media Matters with Marie Buskey and Marty Gibson, discussing the media through the RCR lens,
right here on Reality Check Radio.
Good afternoon and welcome back to Reality Check Radio. You're with Marie now for Media Matters, and joining me is Marty Gibson, as he does. How are you, Marty?
I'm really good. How are you?
I am good. Do tell me about these avian adventures that are going on in your backyard.
Well, I have mentioned before that I've got chickens. We've got 8 chickens. We switched to a more carnivorous diet, and so I live to a large extent on steak and eggs. And so I'm self-reliant on egg-wise for the family. So this morning we had a 10-egg frittata for breakfast. And I sort of had an extensive vegetable garden. So I've got less than a quarter-acre section here in Papa Moa. In the maybe six or seven years that I've lived in this house, I've put in about 30 fruit trees. I think I've raised the level of the soil up by it'd be a foot in places and a bit less than that in other areas, but you can really see the neighbour's got a lawn, and the level of my backyard used to be the same level as his, but it's a lot higher now. So yeah, mostly my backyard has been given over to chickens, and so I'm just sort of taking a bit back, and where they've been pooping and eating fish heads that I get from next door, I'm going to put a garden in and mostly put berries and chicken greens. So I've got a nice chicken greens mix from King Seeds.
There you go.
That's what I've been doing. Well, maybe I should make a social media post on my Twitter or something like that.
That's a good idea. I know. Having seen your food forest as it was before the chickens arrived, it's lots of fun.
You don't need much land to do a lot with, and it's a great pleasure in a mixed agriculture model. It's a lot of work, and it's highly productive, and it's beautiful. I really enjoy being in my garden, and right, especially around spring, summer, I always leave flowers there. And so it's got a lot of birds and insects, and there's a joy in it. There's a joy in being in a garden. And as I read somewhere, and I found this to be true, there's never a problem with pests. There's only a problem with deficiency in predators. And so if you do keep those flowers, especially the upturned ones, you get the parasitic wasps and things like that. And I never have big problems with disease.
Mm. Actually, that's actually brought up, and it's a nice little segue, really, because nature has always got a funny way of finding balance, doesn't it? And One of the things that I've noticed is there's no such thing as equity in nature.
Yes. Yeah, the Pareto distribution kills all arguments that emphasize the rightness of equity and equality, don't they? You can, mm-hmm. the stars in the universe, trees in the forest all follow this. There are some big winners and some not so big winners.
Yeah, which then sort of followed on to another theme that I pulled out, because there was a dearth of actually news. Lots of it was quite scrappy, and it was like, how do we pull all of this together? Because there was a fabric there that I could feel, but I couldn't put my finger on it. And it wasn't until I went to bed the other night, and I often go to bed listening to the dulcet tones of Rodney Hyde, but I decided to mix it up and did Leighton Smith for a change. And as I was scrolling through to find which of the Leightons I'd like to listen to, because I hadn't listened for a wee while, I discovered our favourite disagreeable, irascible professor, Professor Rob McCulloch.
And the down-to-earth Kiwi, you can read
his. The down-to-earth Kiwi, yes. And I thought, a dose of Rob, that's what I need. Now, he did a wonderful conversation. You've spoken to him, as have I, with For the State. And one of the things that came out of that conversation, he's a macroeconomics professor, so he looks, big pictures is his thing. And I suddenly realised there's the theme. I think we've forgotten how to work. What do you think?
Well, I mean, we've spoken about this quite a lot, haven't we? I mean, I really formed my opinions on that working as a cleaning contractor in London, where I hired a lot of people. And I observed that, different people, some people go better than others. And that's led to my antipathy toward the minimum wage, because the minimum wage means you can't pay what your best workers are worth because you're paying your worst workers what they're not worth. And your best workers become disillusioned with getting paid the same as the Muppets. And the Muppets are getting paid the same as the good guys. So why would they improve? So I think it's a drag on productivity. It incentivizes in the wrong directions. I'm not sure if I've run through my 1 to 5 worker classification, but I can run through it real quick. And if you employ people, you know who's who in the zoo with this classification. Number ones are the ones that everyone wants to hire because they're super conscientious, super efficient. The main thing with them is they're kind of highly strung. Often their work output is like a nuclear power plant. It's just a barely controlled explosion. And the main caution with those guys and girls is you don't want to tell them off as a group. They hate being included in a group dress down. Never do that. It knocks them off balance in a way that's beyond all reason. Number two is the ones who look at you and think, man, that guy's doing all right. This is a pretty good gig. I wouldn't mind learning to do this. This looks like, you know, quite a good thing. And, you know, they're good too. That they're conscientious because they're aspirational. And if you put a number one and number two together, you can just have a dynamite team. If you've got a business in a small town, you're training in competition. Number three is most people really. They could go either way according to how they're managed. They'd sort of turn up and they're influenced by the culture and who's around them. And they can, you know, they can get better or worse with time and with the management. Number fours are the ones who look at you and think, look at all the money that prick's making. Why should I bust a gut just to make him richer? So they're the socialists and the unionists, and they're basically, they're there to look after themselves and basically just make your life difficult. They are the people going around moaning. And so they just sort of try and bring the atmosphere down, make everyone feel oppressed. Number fives are just the ones you hire accidentally if you're short on numbers, and you know they're not going to go well often, but you can never manage them enough to make a profit because they break things, steal things, hurt themselves. They just don't go well. And we're making more and more of those people.
Mm.
And so there, that's Marty's 1 to 5 management system as a Media Matters bonus.
There you go. The two big things that I got out of Rob's discussion were around the loss of meritocracy and loss of in productivity, and the two of them sort of quite often go hand in hand. And I don't know whether you saw this. When I cast my eye across the papers over the weekend in the last sort of few days, there was story after story after story that sort of encapsulated that. And one of the first ones is, we've talked about this here, is for weeks and weeks and weeks now, especially the Post, latterly the Sunday Star Times, potato, potato.
The Sunday Star stuff.
Yeah, Sunday Star stuff, have been going on and lamenting the woes of Wellington. Oh, Wellington, oh, Wellington, yeah. Oh, Wellington is suffering. It's suffering, and it's suffering so badly. And all the businesses where there's been key closures, all of a sudden, a no-shit Sherlock moment has happened, and Nicola Willis announces that really public service departments need to relook at their flexibilities and criteria for those working at home. Because apparently, since COVID, whilst most of the private sector has come back to work in the office, the public sector, not so much. And Heather Duplessis-Allen covered them. I haven't heard of this name. They're called twats, apparently.
Yeah, I was going to say twats, yeah.
Yeah, twats. Yeah, twats, which stands for Tuesday, Wednesday and Thursday. And I mentioned it the other day when I was down there because Monday was like a ghost town. There was just no one in Wellington because they're all stuck out at the beach house or the batch or the other, you know, over the hill in the Wairarapa. Yeah. And they're not at work where they should be.
Mm. A business like a restaurant runs on number ones. You need a number one to make a business like that work. And the good thing is if you then bring in new staff and they've got exposure to that number one and you can point at them and go, that's how to work. That's what it takes to do a great job. Then, you know, that they can emulate that to a certain extent. And that was the problem with having Marxist student politicians who've never had a real job in their life, much less employed anyone such that the person's performance was a determinant of whether or not they got paid. They're like, sure, why not? Shut down. Yeah. So what's happened is there are a lot of hospitality businesses having to restart and hire new staff that haven't got those number ones or twos. And so they're just in this fuddle of muppetry.
Well, and unfortunately, too, tertiary education is banging out number threes left, right, and centre.
Well,
number threes and
number fours. You could argue number fours.
They're
banging out a lot of number four, a lot of people with a lot of resentment and kind of, you know, this belief that they're hard done by. You know, as I've said, that voice when you start exercising, when you haven't exercised in a while, it goes, this is bad. Why are we doing this? We could have stayed in bed. You know, that voice has got political representation by Chris Hipkins.
Rob touched on it in his discussion, talking about how graduates now, you know, going out in our day. Now, I never was a graduate. I literally went from doing a year as an exchange student, came back, got a job and started working on the job training. This is the funny thing. I had two jobs for so long that when I finally went down to one job, it felt weird.
Yeah.
Because I'd always had a second
job. You started coasting.
Yeah, it is strange. And now I'm back to two jobs again. And it's kind of like this weird kind of nostalgic thing.
Home.
No, at my age.
Just cortisol levels back up where they belong.
I know, the adrenals are like, oh my God. Maximum levels. However, graduates now, you know, they come out and then start, depending on the job, particularly if you're going into things like hotel management or the like, as a graduate, I mean, you're on the bottom of the food chain. I mean, you theoretically used to, people our age, we'd go out and the job inevitably would have the worst hours. You would be expected to work weekends or nights or, you know, disagreeable sort of shifts. Now these graduates, oh no, we only do, you know, coffee hours, thank you. And we want flexibility to be able to work from home.
I've heard doctors basically foreshadow these problems. And of course, that was a point Rob McCulloch made, was that, you know, the problem isn't that there aren't enough doctors, it's that they're not working hard. And I mean, you may remember, dear listeners, my old man's a grumpy old workaholic type A personality GP, and he would just work stupid hours. When he was a house surgeon, you know, he used to talk about working 80 hours a week sometimes, which is unsafe. Yeah, there's no appetite for that, and there's no appetite particularly among women. And, you know, he often said that, you know, he'd get a locum and they wouldn't want to work weekends, they wouldn't want to work nights, and so they made less money. That's where the gender wage gap comes from.
Well, and also too, I mean, dare I say it, is when you look at medicine now, I mean, a large number of the graduates, I think it's what it is, I know it's predominantly women now that are going into medical school, not men.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it's fairly typical of the pattern in tertiary education generally, where there are 50% more women than men going on to tertiary education. And there was a big whiny article in the Sunday Star Times Business. Did you see that? The long and winding road to gender equality at work.
Oh, yes, I did.
This is where stuff is just becoming unbearable, you know, with the Sunday Star Times, with Three News. And, you know, it sort of looks like a news story, but the woman who writes it, Miriam Bell, is a former employee of the Human Rights Commission. And it quickly just became like a Human Rights Commission press release. But it was kind of, it wasn't a piece of journalism in that it was very propagandist and one-sided. This sort of glib, one big change is that women are getting a lot more education now. 20 years ago, much of the pay gap was attributed to differences in education. Now women have caught up in that space and they enter and graduate tertiary education at a higher rate than men. This isn't a problem for Miriam, though. It's not a problem that 50% more women than men graduating from tertiary education, but it's not translating into pay. Maybe it's because they're studying reality television and crap like that. So much of the gap comes down to unexplained causes, such as unconscious bias.
Oh, the unconscious bias,
unexplained causes. What a mystery, just twisting her hair into pigtails. Oh, how could it be? It's because they don't like working weekends and nights, Miriam. They don't like working in oil rigs. And then she goes on, you know, this quotes, one tool we use is the UN monitoring tool, which is based around the UN Women's Empowerment Principles. You know, then just has a big swing at motherhood. The impact that motherhood has on careers, which we call the motherhood pay penalty, is a big one. Our work on this showed that on average, women experience a 4.4% decline in hourly wages upon becoming mothers. The decrease is even larger for those that take longer than 12 months to return at 8.3%. Spending more than 6 months with your child, comrade. It takes many years to get back to the pre-child earning track. Recovery is quicker the shorter time out of the workforce is, but it still takes a few years, whereas with fathers, there is no change to earnings, unless, of course, like me, they're the E on the LGBTQE thing. They're economic transsexuals like me, and their wife earns more. Our income goes way down. I'm doing my bit for the gender pay gap, Miriam. Don't you worry about that. And women hate it. Much rather I was earning more than them.
And this is the thing, you know, this is another take on motherhood. Yeah. In a way, you know, another take on motherhood.
The anti-human thing that runs through that sickly socialist.
Yeah. To tie things back to the head of the Duplessis, Alan, what Rob was saying, and then there was a third little article that I saw, and it was about kids' screen time having dinner together, family dinners, and that was in the Herald on Sunday. The interesting thing about sort of all of this is they were talking about how they want people to come back to work. Right. So that's public sector workers and those in council. So essentially,
get those twats back at work.
Get the twats back at work. But then in this family dinners article, it was saying that part of the reason that a lot of parents are now not having dinner with their children or they're having separate dinners or the kids are sitting in front of screens is because these parent hours have worked and increased over the past 12 months. And I'm thinking, well, it can't be both. You can't have them not, you know, so what is it? And I suddenly realized, and they won't actually say it, those parents, I bet you dollars to donuts, those parents are self-employed. Because in the private sector, and that for those self-employed parents or those ones who are contractors, they're working every hour in order to make things work. Yeah, we are. And I look at that period of time when I had our kids. I became a contractor as soon as the kids were born because, and especially with number one, with his neurodiversity, and he was a difficult baby, so we knew that there were issues there, and I had difficulty conceiving the children. So contracting was the way to go because contracting meant that I wasn't putting a burden on business as an employee, but I was still offering when I was there and billing, what I was offering was of value. So then it was a win-win situation. It meant that I lost some of those benefits in terms of holiday pay and sick leave and all of that kind of stuff. But I gained the flexibility that I needed to be able to work around family commitments and not have that guilt associated with, oh gosh, I've got to stay home today because my kid's sick or I've got to.
And you've got a great relationship with your kids because one of the ways, and I'd say this as a very involved father, and, you know, I've had three kids back at school today, but Monday, Tuesday, I had three kids homesick from school. Now, yeah, as you say, I've got a few businesses which allow me flexibility so I can go, okay, I'll do a little bit of shuffling. We'll be fine. Kids need that time. One of the ways they sold feminism to women was grossly underplaying how much time is required to raise healthy, well-adjusted children. It does take time. You need a gender wage gap. I mean, you know, it'd be great if you could step up to get more men to do it. But as I alluded to, it's not necessarily ideal.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask men, would you be happy to be married to a woman who earns less money than you? Most men would say, yeah, sure. I don't think you'd get most women saying that. They'd prefer it to be the other way around.
Hmm. Yeah, and if you go back to nature, where we started, is there a gender pay gap in nature, do you think? No.
It's worth really considering for a while how much more efficient production is now with mass production and so on. And yet, even 50 years ago, you could have a man employed to dig ditches, support a woman as a stay-at-home mum, raising three or four kids, and still going to the pub three or four nights a week and getting drunk. You can't do that now, even with both parents working. We've been gradually ground down by, I always bring it back to the people who print money. I think that's where the breadcrumbs generally lead to.
Hey, speaking of ground down, Tori Farnow. God, she's been flopping around more than a kawaii that's caught out on a hot sunny day on a deck. Woo-hoo!
Well, yeah, you can't blame her for taking the job she's been given. Like, and there are people like that. I'm sure she's a nice person and she's probably great fun to get on the booze with. But, you know, like, I mean, brings us back, doesn't it? Regions that elect Green Party candidates should live under their policies in the same way as, you know, I think that would change the complexion of voting.
Well, especially too when she had the gall to say she didn't realise the fullness and entirety that the job would bring. It's like, uh-huh, you know, this is an elected position. I mean, what, did you just think, oh, I'm going to do this for shit and giggles? Oh, good grief. I mean, I think now, just having spoken to some people in Wellington, that whether she will remain the full term, I do not know, because they are certainly over it. And I think you're right. This is what happens when you've got an ideological-based mayor. And also, two Wellingtonians, you voted her in.
Yeah. Well,
you need to sit in that discomfort.
Yeah. You know what allows us to have these little green indulgences, like people are hopelessly inept, like, you know, the various people who without much in the way of skill but a lot of righteous indignation. The only way as a species we can afford those sort of indulgences, fossil fuels. No fossil fuels, no feminism. No fossil fuels, you know, no preoccupation with Marxism. It's the easiness of our life. There's so much fretting about the environmental impact of fossil fuels. I think it's time we started fretting about the effect that constantly available food and heat has had on the human character. It's made us soft. It's made us weak. It's made us neurotic and self-indulgent.
Hmm. But it's the one thing I've always maintained is critical social justice ideology is fueled and fed by affluence.
Yeah.
Always has. Always will be. And actually to that, in the paper, I think I flicked it to you because it was in the Post, the one thing in the Post that I really liked. This one's called Anti-Diversity Backlash. Firms abandon report card on LGBTQ plus rights. Ford, Harley Davidson and Lowe's among companies quitting the Corporate Equity Index. And this is Associated Press is who this comes from. And yeah, it's these big corporates who have suddenly realised all of a sudden, as things are getting a little bit tight, those sort of wah-wah fawning ideological types are not really the consumers. They're not the spenders. And they've actually suddenly realised that fawning to them to do all of these things is actually not improving their bottom line. And in fact, it's detrimental to their bottom line. And they're now starting to roll things back.
I mean, you can read through the paper and you go, that's a press release. That's a press release that someone's knocked into shape. I mean, that thing about how much where the families sit down and eat together, that was a press release from My Food Bag. You can kind of clock that. And this is a press release from some BlackRock, George Soros bullshit think tank, you know. Yeah. And it's got the same airy, just bad reasoning. Diversity, equity and inclusion programs, policies and practices make business sense and they're broadly popular among the public, consumers and employees, their statement read. Oh, is that so? Budweiser didn't find that.
No.
You know, where are your numbers here, champ?
Yeah, I love this one. Harley Davidson posted a statement on X about withdrawing from the index, adding that it did not have hiring quotas or supply diversity spending goals and that employee resource groups will focus exclusively on professional development, networking and mentoring. Well, that sounds awfully like meritocracy to me, Marta.
Yeah.
Careful.
Yeah, no, I mean, Harley Davidson's customer base isn't going to go for that. I've been thinking a bit about inequality lately and how we need more inequality. Not an aggregate, maybe, but we need to try different things in different places and see what works best, and that's going to generate inequality. Like, one of the reasons that we don't seem to make headway on a lot of issues is because we've got that public sector that's so focused on those Marxist ideas of the proletariat all being the same and being widgets, and so they don't try different things in case someone gets ahead. Terrible sort of, it just taps into the worst aspects of human nature. Jealousy, resentment, excuse making. The tide's going out on that stuff, and the danger or the concern is that as that tide's going out, the impulse to authoritarianism is going up. the iron fist's coming out of the velvet glove.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I've been reading back through a bit of Hannah Arendt, went through a little patch of Hannah Arendt quotes, but it's so instructive because there were kind of two important bits of blindness, and I thought in the debacle of the COVID era, and it kind of occurred to me that on the one hand, there was this massive chunk of the population that was simply unable to confront what was going on and went into that fawning, catatonic state, believing things that were obviously untrue for their own comfort and out of their own cowardice. And there was another bit of blindness that exacerbated this, which is the failure of those of us who weren't that way to fully comprehend the extent to which our compatriots were. And this has made our efforts to share information with them less effective. You know, it's easy to become despondent when that happens. You and I have been a bit more suspicious than most with your interest in Matthias Desmet's mass formation psychosis and my early understanding that a lack of quality, well-researched writing wasn't the problem. The problem was that we were trying to fill buckets that had the lids on.
Yeah.
And I think that's still our problem. That Saks Telegraph cartoonist Bob Moran said something in an interview a couple of weeks ago that just rocked me on my heels. He said, the hardest thing for people to believe is that people in control are actively trying to harm them.
Yeah. Yeah.
He said that's something they just can't get over. And, you can go back through Hannah Arendt and read what she says about totalitarianism 80 years ago. And it's just, you go, yeah, that's it. Especially around cynicism, how totalitarianism works through cynicism, because it allows people to say they're all the same. It's all bullshit, isn't it? It's all just politics. And it allows people to be gullible and disbelieving at the same time.
It also, too, reminds me of that Mark Twain quote, it's easier to fool people than to convince them that they've been fooled.
Mm.
And that is what we have right now. And I don't know, you probably didn't read this, but it was the guest opinion piece that pops up in the Sunday Star Times. And usually I skim over it and don't bother, but this morning I did. And it's called Real Challenge Comes When a Collective Struggle Becomes an Individual One. So, of course, you did read that. Okay, so instantly my little spidey senses go up, you know, collective, individual.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like, oh, hold on a minute here.
Well, the Mental Health Foundation.
Mental Health Foundation. As Mental Health Awareness Week kicks off tomorrow, so that was this Monday, just gone, we are reminded that one of the most powerful resources we have in the face of adversity is each other. The theme this year is community is. What we create together speaks to the heart of how we've managed to pull through some of our toughest times in recent years, whether it's been the rising cost of living, the aftermath of COVID-19, not COVID-19, the aftermath of COVID-19, or extreme weather events. And I think there are many of us and many listeners here that will actually understand the value of all of that, because all of us, we would not be sitting here.
Oh.
Saying, talking and doing, if it weren't for that community that came together during COVID-19. He then goes on and talks about Cyclone Gabrielle, especially. I can fully concur with the feelings and sentiments around the importance of community during that time, having, you know, survived through Cyclone Gabrielle and seeing how incredible the neighbours and the people that live around me are and how we pulled together and how proud I was that we did what we did. Later, he then says, in speaking to people throughout the country, it's clear that loneliness is a significant issue. Earlier this year, the Mental Health Foundation commissioned a research to understand the impacts of Cyclone Gabrielle and other extreme weather events on well-being. 4 out of 10 New Zealanders surveyed felt lonely at least sometime in the previous 2 weeks. You mentioned Hannah Arendt. Hannah Arendt is at the core of the research that Matthias Desmet did when he wrote his book, The Psychology of Totalitarianism. And one of the 4 pillars to make people susceptible to a mass formation is loneliness. Loneliness is massive.
Yeah.
And I looked at this and I thought, all the ingredients are still here to bake that totalitarian cake. And we need to be really vigilant. And that's where I actually found this column quite hopeful, because he's right. We do actually need to pull together. And I think this is a community, those who listen to the station or those who have woken up to some of the, you know, jiggery pokery that's going on by our dear leaders out there, that actually, yeah, we need to have conversations. We need to talk. We need to chat. We need to listen to each other. We need to actually have that old-fashioned notion of helping a mate out. You know, those conversations you'd have over the back fence, like if you're in your yard with your chickens and say, do you want me to give you a hand with that fence? Oh, that'd be great, mate. Would you like a dozen eggs? Know, those sorts of things. I think we've lost the, a lot of communities have lost the ability, or people, particularly in urban areas, have lost that ability.
The door to go through to get to that is to accept, as Bob Moran said, that there are people who hold a great deal of power who mean you harm, who think there are too many people on there. Now, that's a tough thing to swallow, but you've got to quickly switch to, okay, well, what do you do? And yeah, you get together with, and how great it is being with people who end the gaslighting, because they go, yeah, I can see that too. Hannah Arendt quote, the point is that both Hitler and Stalin held out promises of stability in order to hide their intention of creating a state of permanent instability. And, you know, that brings you to the Isaiah 5:20 quote that I thought about when those 400 members of the cloth signed that protest against an examination of the Treaty Principles Bill, saying that an examination of race-based law and a questioning whether it was relevant to modern New Zealand was racist. And I thought of that Isaiah 5:20, woe unto them that call evil good and good evil, that put darkness for light and light for darkness, that put bitter for sweet and sweet for bitter. And so much of that Luciferian reverse speaking is it's gaslighting.
Yeah.
And so you've got to get out of that, and we've got to do something positive. And the Times, there was a great interview between Tucker Carlson and Alex Jones, where they were saying, there are people who are right. Okay, I've accepted that there is a really active evil agenda at work here, and I don't care if they kill me.
Yeah,
I'm committed that that may happen, and I will be happy to at least know that I'm doing the right thing rather than cowering.
You know how there's those old sayings, like she said, you had that biblical quote, but there's also those sayings that often have meaning in practical effect, like I'm going from the frying pan into the fire.
Yeah.
You just need to look at the United Kingdom.
Yeah, and Chippy's gone over to see...
Exactly. That's where
see what he can learn.
So that's exactly where I was heading with that, because Keir Starmer did not win that election. The Conservatives lost it. As I said, most powerful voting base, those that stayed at home. Keir Starmer got less votes than the deeply disliked Jeremy Corbyn. But because of the nature of their system and how it's all built up, he now is leading, believing he's got a mandate, and he's now more, he's got, what was it, a favourability rating that's even worse than Rishi Sunak, and he's only been there 5 seconds, and Chippy's gone over thinking he's going to find some bright ideas to bring back to the Labour Party. Well, good night. And then on top of all of that, Shane Tupou, he had some ideas of his own that were starting to sound very unlike Shane Tupou and very unlike the Labour Party.
Yeah, well, as I said, I think he's working for the Helen Clark Foundation. I think that he's getting some of his marching orders from Dear Leader. There is a lot of that third way in what Shane Tupou is saying now, whereas before he was more of a sullen ethno-nationalist Marxist. Mm. Now he's got the third way Fabian thing going on that just reeks of Helen Clark.
And to all of that, I think that's where that column from the Mental Health Foundation is, where ourselves, us as individuals, we need to be mindful of not being reactionary, which I think they were accusing Chris Hipkins of, and Labour, Andrea Vance was accusing Chris Hipkins and Labour having reactionary politics. And even she was outlining some ideas that Chris Hipkins could use, which were all, again, sounding rather centrist and very unlabored.
Very central planning Politburo, weren't they? And you know, you've got to always remember the word reactionary is a very important word in Leninism, more than Marxism, because Leninism was a practical application. And it's, hey, some people aren't going to like this. They're reactionary. Reactionary is a very important word to them. What she was proposing was very much, you know, central planning, state-owned enterprises by way of, let's see, yeah, by way of bleak contrast to those prevailing winds of New Labour optimism. This is back when Tony Blair was elected. The first weeks of Starmer's premiership have been marked by right-wing riots, turmoil over stripping pensioners' winter fuel allowance and a donations row. But still, after the year he's had and the poll results he's just had to swallow, it would be churlish to begrudge Hipkins a good victory knees up with his British comrades. I mean, you know, the right-wing riots arresting older middle-aged, you know, middle-aged and older English women for liking
Facebook posts.
Yeah, so letting rapists out of jail so you can lock up those, characterizing people protesting random killings of young girls by migrants as right wing. Darth Vance.
Yeah. Yep. Shane Tupou, of course, he was taking his wife at Energy, and his solution, and that's where you did right, actually, the Helen Clark Foundation had the stamp all over it of that. Of course, their solution was to go all Kiwi Bank, solution for power, and create a New Zealand state-owned energy generator. Look, call me crazy, haven't we been here before, Marty? Well, and it certainly isn't working in broadcasting, just saying.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know what does annoy me a little bit is, as he said, the taxpayer, and I agree with some of the points he's making. Mm. I think there is a case to be made, certainly for splitting generation off from retailing. I think that's a big part of our problem. The whole Max Bradford market system is a dog's breakfast that, you know, the best person to listen to on that is Brian Leyland. Dig up his most recent interviews with, I know he did one with Paul, I think, and he's probably done one with Leighton Smith, I think, which was excellent. But, yeah, I mean, he said, I've talked before about a Kiwi Power idea, a publicly owned power generator that's not out for profit but to reduce energy costs for our economy and households. It would be empowered to take over those consented projects that the Gentiles refuse to build and do it for them. It would enter into long-term deals with companies that want to build offshore wind and large-scale solar farms but need to know they'll get a steady return on investment to make it worthwhile. Sounds like a profit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, it does annoy me that the taxpayers paid for these hydro power dams and now we have to pay through the nose for power from them. It annoys me that we're importing Indonesian coal to burn at Huntly when we're leaving our own coal in the ground and it's much better.
Again, frying pan fire.
Mm.
Frying pan fire. And it's almost like, as you said, Luciferian, the sort of fire of the bits of hell. One of the other examples of that I did, an interview I did last year? I lose track, but with Magat Ward, the Senegalese entrepreneur, and she was talking about the history of Africa and how there was that vacuum created. You know, they all talk about, you have these groups that talk about the how bad colonization is for so many of these countries. The colonizers then walk away and allow sovereignty within these own countries to rule themselves. But of course, they're used to having somebody help hold their hand, right, all the way through. Their sovereigns leave. They're now on their own. So what did they do? They go to the repository of bad ideas. And for most African nations, it was Leninism or Marxism or a combination thereof. So you then had these either socialist or dictator states. South America saw a few of them, and Venezuela is still existing to this day. And it's almost that whole fourth turning thing, isn't it? You know, for the West, are we now heading back into that place where we're saying, oh, we don't want colonization anymore. Oh, we don't want all this independence. We need someone to hold our hand because we need anything.
Yeah, I mean, you can really get into the weeds pretty quickly with this. You know, I mean, if you look at a map of African countries, colored in according to IQ is revealing, and you mustn't talk about that. And I think the other forbidden idea is the drive against what's called white supremacy. I'm often suspicious that it's not about race so much as Western democracy was inching closer to a really beautiful, stable, non-tyrannous state where humans could really sort of move beyond fighting for survival and move into being much more thoughtful and creating you know, moving from beyond survival. And that was no good.
Mm.
It was no good for the fat controllers. People who are completely satisfied are hard to sell for the consumer goods too.
Yeah, yeah. It's quite interesting. At the moment, I'm rewatching the last few days, and this came out of this lunch I had on Sunday, and with our lovely Bonnie, who's our breakfast producer, was with me. And she happened to mention on the way home that her and her daughter have been watching Star Wars films. And I said to Mr. Marie, I said, oh, I haven't watched any of these films for ages. So we decided to start with episode one. I know there are purists out there that think 1 to 3 shouldn't exist, but we're starting with episode one. And so we've done the first two, episode 1 and 2, finished the second one last night. It's incredible when you don't watch a film for quite some period of time. And I mean, these films, these prequels, nearly 20 years old now.
Right. Okay. I was going to ask, so Star Wars, the first one that came out in the 70s, wasn't episode one, was it?
No, that was episode four.
I've watched Star Wars, I've watched The Empire Strikes Back, and I think I've watched Return of the Jedi.
Right. Okay. So that's 4, 5, and 6. So I'm currently doing the three prequels, which is 1 through 3. What is it really interesting is that the prequels, of course, address how you get to those ones that came out in the 70s and 80s, right? When you actually watch them now, I probably haven't watched these films in more than a decade. You watch them now and you look at the whole political overtone of these films. This is the thing. I don't think there are people out there like those ones in Wellington, you know, those twats who think that they're actually the Rebel Alliance that now ceded control and now created this brave new world, when really, in fact, they're the Empire and they've not cottoned on to this yet.
With Darth Vance.
Exactly. Anyway, we could go on. I have just looked at the time. Time's getting away from us. And I don't want to miss out on this because we have had some incredible feedback this last week. Thank you, everybody. It must be the new day and time. It must be the new day and time that you guys are liking. So I'm going to kick things off first with our friend Mike. Hi, Mike. We love you, Mike. Hi, Marie and Marty. I just wanted to add that I would like to get some reparations from the Italians. That's right, we were talking about that last week, weren't we? The reparations, because they invaded England and killed many of my English ancestors. So could you please start up a little page so we can go and fund and get to start the process of suing the Italian government for past grievances to my family? I'm wondering if there are any cavemen that want to go back to a military compensation from. Should we be all ashamed of our past and all the damage we've done to everyone worldwide and keep putting our hand in our pocket to compensate them because money is the only way of doing it? Just a thought, not so ridiculous at all. Cheers, Mike from Foxton. And that, of course, is in response to the two sisters that went to Jamaica that we talked about and apologised. Do you want to talk about reparations? This one is from the text machine. Hi, Marie and Marty. Add the amount of babies killed through abortion to our declining population. Cheers, Rowan. Yes, actually, that's something that we've not discussed. I actually am in the process of Rowan finding somebody around that issue, the abortion issue, pro-life issue, to actually have a chat to. We're in the throes of that for Counterculture, so watch out for that in coming weeks.
There was actually a really sobering graph that I saw that came out of the States, and it was a Wall Street Journal poll that was from February of this year, and it had top issues for young voters. And for the economy, there was something like over twice as many. It was a concern for twice as many young men as young women. Abortion was, women were 7 times more worried about abortion than young men. And someone had posted that with, for young men, the most important issue is to be able to get a job to support a family. For young women, the most important issue is to be able to kill their baby. It's stark, that level of difference.
Yeah, and also too, is it the idea of it or the actual action of it? Because, I mean, the birth rate is plummeting. So many women aren't even having children. So it's like the idea of something that they have been indoctrinated to, that they believe that they have a right that they must have.
Well, they're getting told that the earth's going to boil in 10 years. And
I just, I find it really intriguing. Anywho, that's...
Yeah, I mean, you know, Jacinda Ardern, I think I posted this back on Cam's page, you had a photo of Jacinda Ardern and Justin Trudeau, and I remarked that these two are the sort of Maos and Hitlers we get when women have more influence in politics. They're kinder, more softly spoken, and with better hair.
Mm. Yes. We haven't got time to touch on this, but I was talking to you. I don't know whether you caught me chatting to Brev yesterday, but yes, it looks like things aren't all rosy for Wayne Justin. It looks like the floppy head, you know, puppy boy, good looks are not winning him over with the voters anymore. Anyhow, to Marty and Marie, thank you both for your media-related chats on Media Matters. Together, you expose and comment on a variety of stories that give intelligent analysis, different perspectives in the handing out of the old bouquet or brickbat or eye roll. I always feel better informed and entertained by your show. Thank you, Joanne. Oh, Joanne.
Thanks, Joanne.
Making us blush.
We probably haven't covered, like, I'm sure we've got quite a few media clippings around that are covered in highlighter that we haven't even touched on
today. I know. We've hardly heard a rustle of newspaper today. Both of us have been far too busy ranting around the Zooms out. Sorry about that, guys. Media Matters constantly hits it out of the park. Oh, Joe, it's so refreshing to hear the objective analysis without feeling like I'm being lectured to or brainwashed. I love how you both can leave space for alternative perspectives and even agree and acknowledge the occasional adversaries when appropriate. Solid work again. Thanks, Stu. Oh, thanks, Stu. I appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Stu. That's very heartening to hear that that is how you're finding it.
Got one here that came in from Facebook, The Egalitarian. I might have even actually been Twitter or X, to be honest, tagged in Paul Goldsmith MP. He's followed Lee into incompetence. He's done nothing apart from talking up, coercing Facebook, etc., to pay lying legacy media money to keep the lie, to keep lying to us. I feel he's too busy to do a proper job and no media management skills. Shane Jones, Peters, Seymour and Brown all do. I'm not sure what reference. I think it could be a clip that's actually on X at the minute. On that one. And lastly, another one from Mike. Oh, I do like. I like the Mike sandwich. This is nice. Just this one literally has just come from the inbox team. Hi, Marie and Marty. Just a note to let you know, guys know that I'm still listening. I'm still loving what you both do. I listened to Jess Preet and Don this week while squeezing lemons for our cheesecakes that we have on a Friday potluck night dinners in Foxton. We have them every 5 or 6 weeks or so. And what a treat that their interviews were with Margaret Byfield, C40 Cities. Did you hear that? Because I know you love listening to lots of Jess Preet and Don.
Yes, I. And, you know, we're left with the same problem that you've got. If you're in the car driving and you're listening to interviews, you can take them in, but it's very hard to index them in the same way as you can when you're reading a book.
Exactly.
But I've been listening to a lot more Jess Preet and Don lately. I listen to a lot of Dewar Du Bois. Some Simon, some Rodney. I've been really enjoying RCR lately as a listener.
The show really does make a person think, and their guests are always top shelf, always engaging, still getting used to the new schedule. Making it work with Martin, the Fourth Estate, is always a must listen, though less Mr. O'Connor. Mike's not Simon's greatest fan. I still can't forgive that man for what he didn't do during the protest. There you go. The Boilermakers' staunchness always showing out. You never lose your staunchness, Mike. That's something that we absolutely love about you. Maybe one day I'll get over it, but not just yet. Anyway, as usual, you're both doing a fantastic job. So thank you and all the RCR team that make this only station worth listening to. Cheers, Mike. Well, thank you for the Mike sandwich. We do appreciate that.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And you know, you've been such a great encourager through this journey of the last 18 months. And yeah, it's a weird thing talking to so many people, just sitting at the kitchen table by myself in the house.
I know. We're
talking to you, Marie, when, you know, it's something we did anyway without so many people listening. So we probably had a few media matters.
I know. And here I am, you and I, living in our glass houses, giving all the twats a bit of a serve when I'm sitting in Busky's bedroom broadcasting base and you're sitting...
You know what the difference is, though, Busky?
What?
We're not taking taxpayers' money to do it.
True!
We're making a value proposition. People pay us for what we do, and if we don't do it, and if we don't do what they want, they don't pay us. It's not like that for those public servants. It's not like that for the twats.
No, it's not like that for the twats. There you go. There you go.
There's quite a bit. I mean, you know, there was a Stephen Joyce article, which we always like to go over, who was, you know, he's talking about we need to really get serious about economic recovery and the gangs are sidetracked. I kind of agree with you. I thought.
Yes, same.
William Dempsey made a good case on that when we were on the political panel last week. And I think both of us agreed with him on that. It's,
yeah,
you know, not the way. There's plenty of laws that they're breaking anyway that you can enforce without something that could cause the barn door to swing. There's the usual climate nonsense, a lot of shrill headlines on
EV car sales plummeting and they need intervention to get them back up.
EV car sales plummeting. There's Liam Dan's saying that lower population growth certainly means that monetary policy will have to do more heavy lifting. Right, okay. There's fears from the public service that the scale of government cuts could dwarf those to date, and it's got a lot of, yeah, a lot of public servants twisting the hair into pigtails saying, well, I don't know where we're going to get the savings. Not really acknowledging that Public Service Commission data shows the number of workers increased 31% from 49,730 in 2018 to 65,283 in 2024. The largest increase was to information professionals who are, you know, at home now, which grew 63%. While call center workers had the biggest fall. Overall 50% of the public service is made up of inspectors and regulatory officers. That's saying 17.8%, so I don't know how they quite square those. But, yeah, I think we need to chop the public service right back to the point where we notice that it's not there, because one of the things you notice with having children, and I say this a lot, children need to be bored to be creative. Mm-hmm. And I think equally as a nation, we need to have some gaps where government's not growing between us like metastasizing cancer.
Mm.
So we get a bit more inventive.
Exactly. As homework for everybody, I want you to go and look up the Social Investment Agency. That's where Cuddles has popped off to now that he's resigning as police commissioner. And when you jump on there and it shows you what they are and their reports, it's all about the data, darling. You need to look up the Diversity, Inclusion and Equity Report. There you go. This is your homework, everybody. Make sure you're sitting down. If you need a laxative, it's better than kiwi fruit. That's all I have to say. And on that note, 2057 is text in inbox at realitycheck.radio is the email if you want to send us some comments, your thoughts or feedback. We need to go, Marty.
I know it's flowing. Well, if I can give some homework, go back and listen to Digby Furno, host of Man on the Run podcast, on the global agenda. It was on Paul Brennan's show on the 23rd of September. I found that one was a cracker. Anyway, a bit of a different show this week, isn't it? Bit rantier, but lively. I'm in a good mood. You're in a goodish mood.
It's nice to mix things up. And we'll do it all again next week.
Have a great week, everyone.
Thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas. From great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers and more, the RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.